Oh, hey there. I'm Guy Branum, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over all the pop culture we love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining, but mostly just books today, are journalist and novelist Margaret Wappler.
Hey there, Guy. You're wearing your floral poncho.
I'm wearing my floral poncho. It is summertime. I was off summering with my book, My Life as a Goddess, now available. You have to buy it. A lot of you have not bought it, so buy it. Mm-hmm. And we really have an obligation, now that I am back, to just sort of own the end of summer. And I have to say, nowhere has really made me savor end of summer like Pop Rocket. I feel like us ritualizing, like, you know, like the VMAs and summer jams lining up. Summer book club. I mean, this is a place that's about late summer.
It's so true. Like, we don't really care about the holiday season, whatever that crap's about. Yeah. We're all just about the late summer vibes.
Because the holiday season gives us repetitive topics that we don't like.
It belongs to Alonzo Duralde, frankly.
Oh. That's true. It's his baby.
In what way?
I mean, you know,
he's like a written
a book about Christmas. Yes. He's already on his countdown to Christmas. Like, yes. He is the Christmasologist.
And of course, we have academic author and dyke about town who is very late summery with the outfits.
The outfit is just like a day in abject lesbiana. I don't think you see the back of my t-shirt, which has a cat butt on it. Hold on. Let me
please give. Oh, yes.
I bought it from the Cotton Cabinet in Amsterdam. And, you know, late summer means getting everything ready before school starts. So we ran all of our the week before school starts errands, not back to school, because these had nothing to do with school.
Yeah.
It just meant we were two lesbians at IKEA eating hot dogs at 2 p.m., like after buying a bunch of useless crap.
I think you mean making your syllabus time for you guys, right?
We're
procrastinating
done.
Your
We're
syllabus.
We're done, though.
Oh, those. Whoa.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
And a very special guest, not here to talk to us about popular culture, but just in winter spot, if only to say a certain phrase. It is our old beloved producer, the resplendent Christian Duenas.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello, Christian. How are you doing?
I'm all right. I really missed you guys.
I missed you.
Just so you know, guys, we meet up before to talk just a little bit before the recording. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, I really missed these little 5-minute meetings.
Well, it's lovely to have you back around the studio. Coming up on this week's show.
Whoa! Please introduce my.
I'm sorry. Margaret rolls deep these days.
She has an entourage.
Yeah, I have an expansive posse, and one member is here.
Flynn Wappler, her canine American family member, is here being a very good boy, very charmingly splayed away from me. Coquettishly, towards the door. No one's getting eye contact from Flynn. All right, coming up, Flynn will be discussing the book. Coming up on this week's show, you guys, it is Pop Rocket Summer Book Club. We are finally talking about Crazy Rich Asians.
Ooh,
plus, we'll each be sharing our latest jams. But first, let's find out what arts and entertainment news or events that are only within the book Crazy Rich Asians or one of its sequels we are all about this week. It's special rules since we love this book so much. We wanted to make our all abouts from Kevin Kwan's Crazy Rich Asians. Margaret Wappler, what are you all about from Crazy Rich Asians?
Well, the book is obsessed with name dropping at all times, right? Fashion labels, any kind of luxury good that the rich people, the crazy rich Asians of the book will buy, it's dropped profusely and constantly. And one of the ones that I enjoyed the absolute most, and in general, Astrid was my favorite character, which I'm sure a lot of people feel that way because she is very aspirational, let's be honest.
Yeah.
But Kevin Kwan's description of her fashion it-girlness, I thought was really amazing. This is his description. Astrid was the first to wear a vintage Saint Laurent lace smoking jacket with $3 batik shorts bought off of beach vendor in Bali. The first to wear the Antwerp 6 and the first to bring home a pair of red heeled stilettos from some Parisian shoemaker named Christian. It's like a perfect capture of like his cheekiness and his obsession with the kind of cool factor that she has that really none of the other rich people in the book has.
Like the raw confidence around her. Like two of my favorite things in the entire book were things about Astrid's fashion. First of all, that pair of earrings that like he describes as being almost ugly and sort of like a thing that no one else could wear and that she wears with an extremely simple outfit to like sell themselves at sort of like the first big all family like scene that we have. It was fascinating. It was one of those things that, like, is so great in a novel when there's something deeply visual that you kind of can't understand that it, like, are this amazing symbolic enigma. And then the other thing was at Colin Coo and Armanita's wedding. When, is her name Armanita?
Araminta.
When Araminta, like, this character who's, like, a very minor character, we flash to her POV for a moment and realize that Araminta only had this $100 million wedding essentially to see what Astrid would wear. Like that Astrid would have to, and that feeling meant so, like I understood that feeling entirely of just wanting this person of greatness to have to do a thing in service of you or your event or your night. And the fact that she just wore an extremely basic Changsam, like vintage from like her grandmother, and Araminta being crestfallen and pissed in equal measure.
Isn't it that she wears the same dress to all weddings now?
That comes up in China Rich Girlfriends.
Okay,
yes.
Sorry.
But tell about it.
Well, just that you must forgive me because I'm going to keep doing stuff like that. But essentially that, you know, Astrid explains that she showed up a bride once.
Yeah.
And it like wreaked havoc in her like personal and social worlds. And from that moment on, she swore to dress exactly the same way and very simply so that she would never be at risk of taking some of the shine from the bride.
Yeah.
You know, so.
No favoritism, showing that one wedding is more important than the other.
And that's essentially, you know, like that's the essence of Astrid is that, you know, is a kind of effortlessness that comes with good breeding, right?
Or
that
yes.
I think that, you know, she herself is not at all aspirational. She is what people aspire to because she has this kind of international, transnational aesthetic and style and like.
Well, it's the $3 batik shorts.
Yeah, like, that was what sealed it for me. Yeah. A lot of the rich people in this book are rich but with no taste.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And she has taste. Like she's able to say, I don't care about the price tag. This is cool and interesting and unexpected.
Or with taste that was handed to them by the British Empire 200 years ago.
Yeah.
You know? And she is this like, we'll get to the book. All right, Karen, what are you all about?
Well, the thing that I'm all about in the Crazy Rich Asians trilogy is, and I'm stepping again beyond the first book, but this has no spoilers in it. All I want to say is that there is a character in China Rich Girlfriend who is undergoing an image makeover and has hired an image consultant. And she receives many different rules around how to dress, what kind of jewelry to wear. But my favorite part of that exchange is a reading list that this character is given to complete, her education. She's essentially being My Fair Lady, right? And to give her a sense of, you know, having the right things to talk about, also the right frames of cultural reference as opposed to popular culture. And I think that that's also Kevin Kwan's effort at nodding to some of his own inspirations, at least, you know, the inspirations that fed this book, at least, you know, in terms of its kind of structure and the ways in which it handles manners and class. Among these books, Trollope's, all of Trollope's books, apparently, but starting with Barchester Towers And we have...
You're the only person in this room who has read Trollope.
I don't know, can you forgive? I love it. Anyway. And yeah, but a lot of these books about manners, I think Thackeray was in there as well,
yeah.
which I want to talk about this a little bit later when we talk about the book, is that to me, this resonates as a real spin on these Thackeray, like Vanity Fair.
I love the headnots. Yeah. Love the headnots.
And then, and also, you know, that if she makes it through these series of books, largely kind of from a colonial syllabus, from like English 101, then she might graduate her way to some light Proust.
Or as a breather.
Or as this character thought in their minds, Proust. So anyway, I thought that it was just lovely, and it was the perfect crystallization of, you know, a meta text of everything that's going on, everything that Kevin Kwan is really trying to do in this trilogy is to present another novel about manners and about like families and genealogies and histories.
For me, it is such a sumptuous novel, and it is a novel that is so full of lists and proper nouns. But like, we're given that with all of the luxury spending, with all of the fashion, but also with all of the food.
Yes.
The thing I am all about is pineapple tarts. is that the pineapple tarts as a reflection of, there's just something so great from a book, like dating back to childhood, where it gives you enough things that you know and understand, and then enough of a spin that you're like, how would that work? What's that? but also these pineapple tarts.
These keep coming back throughout the trilogy,
well,
too.
And as the Madeline of this book.
Mm-hmm. Proust, Proust.
As sort of the taste of memory and the taste of a relationship to Tyersall Park and Nick's family and all of these people with nostalgia about these things, but more than that, the very fascinating place of like colonialism and what was left over in Asia after the British were there for 400 years, and this, you know, this Asian modification of like a French preparation being the thing that like is both nostalgic and warming and homing, but also a declaration of status within their world.
It can't be replicated except for by a cook that's worked for the same family all this time, right? Nobody else can figure it out.
Well, and that degree of ownership, and now we're just segueing into the book, as we've all been wanting to do since we started this, but that degree of ownership of the Shang Young family saying, yes, it's half British and half Asian, but only we have this. Only we sit at sort of like the nexus of these two worlds with complete authority. And it's wonderful.
And yet there was this aspect of their food fandom that reminded me of New Yorkers.
Uh-huh.
Like the fact that they all argued with each other about what the best hawker joint was in town. Like that reminded me hardcore of when you ask like three New Yorkers in a room, where's the best place I can get pizza on the Lower East Side? And you will get 500 different answers and they will argue bitterly about it. And then they'll argue about which subway line to take or whatever to
get
there.
In China Rich Girlfriend, there is a moment of beautiful sort of like, it's not just the quality of the noodles, it's also how much you have to pay to park there, coming from billionaireess Eleanor Young. It's magnificent. All right. We have so much to talk about when it comes to this book. We have to take a break. You're listening to Pop Rocket. We're going to be right back to fully get into Crazy Rich Asians right after this.
Hello, I'm Oliver Wong, scholar, journalist, and DJ.
And I'm Morgan Rhodes. I'm a music supervisor. We host Heat Rocks, a podcast where we invite our favorite musicians, writers, and scholars to talk about the albums that have changed their lives. Join us as we discover forgotten classics.
I think that Boots Riley is one of, if not the most underrated MCs in the history of hip-hop.
Reminisce about our faves.
I was always feeling like a little bit of a tourist when I would listen to like Big Daddy Kane. And suddenly when De La Soul came out, it was like, hey, you can dance and be goofy and have fun and love hip-hop, and you don't have to pretend to be anybody but yourself.
And of course, talk nonstop about His Purple Majesty, Prince.
having your idol listen to your music, it's life-changing. It's the thing you want from your parents, so to speak, or that you didn't have.
Heat Rocks, every Thursday here on Maximum Fun.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are...
Margaret Wappler.
And Karen Tongson.
And you guys, it's summer book club episode where I actually fucking read the book.
Yes! So
get pretty excited.
You've already left the first book and gone to the second one, mostly,
it's
right?
It's very good.
Yeah.
Margaret, we're talking about Crazy Rich Asians. For anyone who has decided to go through this without having read or seen Crazy Rich Asians, give a rundown of what Crazy Rich Asians is about.
Crazy Rich Asians has maybe the most characters I've ever seen in a book in the last, like, decade or two of reading. It is stuffed with the crazy rich people of Singapore, basically. But there are two storylines. The first central storyline is Rachel and Nick. This is a couple who live in New York. They are both professors of economics, and they've been dating for 2 years.
Nick's a professor of history.
Yes.
Oh, pardon me. Yes, a professor of history. And they have been dating for 2 years, and Nick has finally invited Rachel back to meet her family, his family in Singapore. And she knows nothing about these people, which I really want to talk about later. Like, how did she not know? How did they never discuss this? Anyway, so she is going to go back to Singapore to meet this family that she knows nothing about. Then... when she gets there, they are much more of a handful than she expected. They are crazy, filthy, just over the top, opulently rich. And she wasn't prepared for this. And they are, on top of that, not really digging her vibe. She is this woman who was born in mainland China, but moved to California pretty soon thereafter. Isn't coming from one of the dynasties that they approve of, isn't from wealth, isn't even new money, just kind of a nobody. And so they're already all talking and thinking about how they can just kick this girl out. And mainly the head conspirator is Nick's mother, who is Eleanor, and who interestingly kind of comes from not the most illustrious family line herself, but she married into a good one. And so she is fiercely protecting her lineage. And the B storyline is, to me, the one that I loved quite a bit more, was Astrid and Michael. So Astrid is a cousin of Nick's, and she is super posh. And as we talked about in the All Abouts, like, she is the fashion it girl. She's cool. She's interesting. She's married to this guy, Michael, who also doesn't really come from any kind of special money. And something's going on with their marriage.
He literally has everything else. He's hot.
Hot
he's smart.
Fuck.
He was in the military.
Yeah.
Like, he's everything except rich. And that means he doesn't matter to these people.
And he's working for, like, he has some sort of tech startup company, but it's not soared yet. And everybody just ends up kind of being like, hey, Michael, can you fix the oven that we paid $500,000 for?
My printer is messed up.
Yeah.
Will you reboot it for me?
And you can tell he's getting sour about all that, but he's hanging in there. And she sees one night that he gets a dirty text on his phone. And she's like, what the fuck is going on? So basically, we're chasing those two storylines. Lines and all along while we're going through their dramas, we get to meet all of these people of Singapore. There's Radio One, this gossip lady Cassandra, who basically has the goods on everyone. There's Oliver Tsien, who is played by Nico Santos,
who was supposed to be here
but he had to film something important, so we forgive him. And, like, he's a great dishy gossip as well, who, like, you know, has this, you know, he basically is organizing and orchestrating.
He's
some...
a gay guy, so he's a gossip with a moral center.
Implicitly gay, though. That's never...
yes.
The important thing to remember about Oliver is that, like, in the books, it's never explicitly stated that he's gay, nor, you know, do we, like, have any sense of him having a partner.
I mean, I should go back
lover.
And just comb through what those first adjectives are.
Because I, like, saw it instantly.
Yes.
I agree. I don't know what they were now, but I just was like,
but
okay.
But the attributes are that...
he's like a dandy, right?
But he dresses dandyically, so a little with a little bit more flamboyance.
Thank you for putting that professorial spin on it.
No, I mean, but more, you know, with more flamboyance than some of the other men. His interests are also in art, and specifically kind of Oriental arts.
Yeah.
Right? So, like, that kind of, you know, that kind of really specific fascination, like with collecting, with also knowing everybody else's business. Okay. He's a gossip, yes. So
but
that's
hence
gay.
Okay, but I'm going to say the thing that most marks Oliver as gay is the fact that he's the one person who directly approaches Rachel and gives her a honey. You know, yeah. I forget what he says,
yes.
But the fact that everybody else, like Astrid is being, likes her, but is like being polite. And with Oscar, there is this sense, with Oliver, there's this sense of just cutting through formality and just going to like brass tacks that like immediately, I mean.
Astrid makes you think of Oscar, aka Oscar Wilde.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, Astrid isn't willing to break the family code.
Right.
Yeah. And he's willing to sort of be like, look, I'm part of this family, but they're also crazy.
Here's the deal.
Like, this thing, when it comes to number of characters, it is fucking War and Peace. So much so that in the second book, they just have a War and Peace like gala. But Karen, it's such a novel-y novel. Mm-hmm. And talk to us a little bit about what makes it such a novel-y novel.
Well, of course, one of the central motifs and frameworks for the novel is like Singapore's relationship to Britain and its British colonialism and some of the inherited kind of class dynamics and forms of social organization that you know, provides.
One of the most beautiful things, I'm sorry for interrupting,
no worries.
But you've met me. I love that family tree you open up with so much, but more than anything, the fact that everybody's grandpa was Sir Something.
Yeah.
Everybody's grandpa was a late imperial knight, and those guys aren't dealt with. We don't hear those stories in the first book. You just know they were part of this system. I'm sorry for interrupting.
No, but I feel like there's only one person who actually has a British title, like Sir James Young, right?
Yes.
But one of the things about the book itself or about Kevin Kwan is that he's obviously playing on and riffing on that kind of colonial legacy in literature as well. On the novel, as I mentioned in my All About, is this kind of the novels of manners, but also of negotiating. So many of these triple-decker Victorian books were about really people trying to figure out their place in an emerging middle class as the aristocracy is crumbling, right? And so that's kind of what we have is like in the wake of, you know, maybe the standards that Nick Young's family has been used to that like adheres to like whatever kind of version of aristocracy and old money existed. You have all of these new people making tons of money, making billions and coming from other places and challenging what is really a kind of sedimented cultural world and turning that upside down with the kind of flash with things that don't adhere to the proper manners or the proper ways of presenting to the world or behaving in a kind of social orbit.
Something that's so interesting about the book, too, is that England is king still, right?
Yeah.
Like, and Europe is king. America is not.
Yeah.
Like, they talk about Stanford as being kind of like the
school so
that, like, people who want to get into Harvard can't go into. Like, if you want to go to a proper, like, prep school that's not in Singapore, you're going to go to England. You're not going to mess around, trifle around with these American schools. Like, that was interesting to me as, like, an aspirational thing about money. Because it's, like, it's not about American new money, of course.
Yeah.
It's about English old money that you are born into it, that it is in, it's like baked into your blood.
Well, this threat of aristocracy, you know, like it is really interesting the way that they describe these people, not in a very American way, as being sort of like a product of work, like having earned your own money. There's no merit in that. It's all about this strange
zero.
Yeah.
Even Charlie Wu, who is a billionaire, right? Who was
like not good enough for Astrid.
Not good.
Fiance in the beginning.
Yeah, her like
or
you
in
know,
the past.
Yeah, from the past. Her fiance who her family rejected, even though it was precisely because his family was self-made. Right. And that there's an origin story where his father like did something mechanical or something like that. Right. Or sold something, you know, like,
Can I get into why I think this is the most like consummate beach read for white people?
Okay.
I think and I read this is from an interview that I read with Kevin Kwan, is that he said, like, he's like, 80% of my readers are not Asian. They're white people. Mm-hmm. And I feel like the reason this is so successful as a beach read is because you can be having a total soapy, dishy, good time just watching people be all trashy on each other about money and sex and blah, blah, blah. But you learn about Singapore and you learn language and you learn geography and culture. So you don't feel like a total dipshit.
One of the things that's key to know is that you notice that the languages that are being privileged are Cantonese and Hokkien.
Yeah.
In Singapore and in Hong Kong, right? Which also gives us a sense of their alienation from the mainland Chinese who speak Mandarin, and which is where Rachel's heritage is located. And, you know, her speaking Mandarin is in fact a big social flub.
The construction of the mainland Chinese as these, like, the newest of money, like, it was a little bit, like, crazy to me that these people whose identities were so invested in being Chinese would look so derisively upon the mainland. And
that was so interesting to me. I wouldn't guess that. I would have thought it'd be the other way around.
Well, it just made me so aware
of, like, the legacy of the Communist Revolution and Mao and, like, re-education and all these different things and the kind of violences that people's families experienced there in the wake of that they had to flee, right?
But,
to
get so to it's sort of places. Like divorce ourselves from that place.
Yeah, divorce ourselves from that, like, official language and from that history to have a different history that's more genteel and linked to British colonialism in Hong Kong and Singapore.
Yeah.
Right?
So this book is such a delightful confection, and it does take place in a world outside of our own, and so is, like, sort of educating, like, people who haven't been exposed to that or thought about it. But beyond that, like, is there more to this book? Is this just a fun soap opera, or is there, do you think there's more of a there?
I mean, if I were to say on the character level, no.
I think that there is real sophistication in the way that this guy tells his story. The fact that you have Astrid's story right alongside Rachel Chu's, and Astrid's story being one of a person, like, she's in a relationship with a person who's better positioned than Rachel Chu, and seeing the problems play out makes it a little bit less that Cinderella story that we're all, you know, ready to be aware of. I really thought that those things playing out against each other, and it's also the very smart way that once you have more than one romantic couple at the heart of something, you can fuck with one of those couples.
Well, I agree with you that the way that they play off of each other is brilliant.
Yeah.
Like, the fact that, and some of it is about, like, when you write, like, a best-selling beach novel like this, like, you have the more interesting stuff happen in the B storyline.
Yeah.
Because the A storyline just has to be the crowd pleaser, right? And so that's just, like, two people coming together, like, of sort of, yeah, the Cinderella rags to riches kind of story in a sense. But then the more interesting stuff actually happens between Astrid and Michael.
I have to say, but there also were, it was very funny when I told my friend Rebecca, not my main friend Rebecca, a different Rebecca, when I told her that, like, she should read this, she was like, oh, does he have a childhood friend who wants to marry him and is trying to break? Like, she basically did, like, three or four points that were totally from the book that anyone could have seen, like, 100 miles off. But I did like that there were a couple of things Kwan fucked with. Like, at the end, I was assuming that mom and grandma will come around because that's what's best for little Nikki. And they fucking didn't.
He's got to write a next book, dude.
I know, but he also doesn't sell out the institution. Like, yeah. You know, like, old Chinese lady's going to be old Chinese lady.
Right. I mean, I just thought, just to continue on this thought of, like, the characters, I one thing I missed from this book is the sort of Jane Austen level of, like, seeing expressions play across people's faces and knowing the kind of, like, social machinations that they're playing on a super minutia level, like, which I just don't think happens in this
book. Rachel's too much of an outsider, you know?
But Rachel and Nick, let's be frank, they're not that interesting.
Yeah,
like, they're
that's
pretty,
very true.
They're pretty, like, vanilla wafers, like, yeah.
And the
oddly
thing,
enough.
The thing is, though, that throughout the trilogy, and even in this book, actually, you know, they provide very minimal and limited plot lines because there's so much more happening.
Yes.
In fact, it's everything else that's happening around them. I think that they're meant to be that kind of boring. And that's where, like, once again, I think that, like, Kevin Kwan's playing with this Trollope stuff because Trollope's narrators always kind of say, well, you know what's going to happen. You know what the plot is.
Yeah.
Right.
But the whole point is, how does this happen?
Yeah.
And what things happen in between? What occasions and circumstances and interactions feed into the thing that you know is an inevitability?
You're reading it for the description of the Singapore airport, you know?
It kind of reminds me, though, of the couple on Downton Abbey that was, like, the maid and the butler.
Oh, no, that
yes! Yeah. Everyone was like, shut up! I don't care about your story
Mr. Bitt.
Anymore.
Yeah.
Where's Baby Bits? Yes, I can't deal with it. Yes.
Or like one terrible thing befalls them after another and you're still like, yeah, I still don't really care.
Yeah.
I mean, these guys didn't have a lot of terrible things happen to them, but it's just, but that's actually kind of a problem too. Is like they're, when it started to get the heat really turned up on her, I was like, okay, let's do this thing.
Yes.
But I was also like, where's her fucking spine? Where's her blowback? Mm. Like, I would be pissed if a man brought me, that I've been with for 2 fucking years, he brought me to Singapore and he's never told me a damn thing.
Okay, like,
that's
how plausible is that?
But he's hot AF.
And, like, they're professors?
Okay, that's a really
She might be dickmatized.
Is this what happens to street ladies? Like, I mean, I won't deny it.
I've seen people do that, but yeah.
Okay,
I just want to say that, like, recently I checked into my balance in my 401k, and then I read this book, and, like, made me want to sob.
No, it is very sad. I mean, I have to say that, like, all of the occasions where I read this book and all the other books in the trilogy, I made sure I was doing something fabulous myself.
Oh, good.
And so that
self-care
I felt like,
while reading Crazy
Yeah, so
Rich
I felt Asians. Like, oh, I'm going to read this while, you know, I happen to have gotten a really great Priceline deal for the Ritz-Carlton in Santa Barbara. So I can feel like I have just a sliver of this, you know, lifestyle.
Oh, the book is at its best when you get, like, a little moment of them. Or it's more in China Rich Girlfriend that you have some moments where they're in upscale California going to, like, Galena or the Post Ranch Inn, and it's like,
yeah,
my world is fancy.
When they had a mention of the Ojai Valley ranch inn, I was just like, thank you, I feel seen.
So Lindy Long on the Facebook group asked, what do you all think it means to be reading a book about the mega rich in the time of Trump? Is it a little uncomfortable to see corruption and consumerism glorified right now, or is it a fun escape?
I don't know if it's glorified as much as, you know, I think that this is one of the things, like, that we haven't quite actually talked about yet, is that, is this at all, you brought the question up, Guy, is this at all a realistic depiction of these certain, like, sets of people or cultures in Asia? And not being a crazy rich Asian myself, but having been adjacent to these worlds in various ways because my family entertained these rich people in Asia, I mean, I can say that, like, I don't know, that there is a lot of historical truth to, or, like, you know, contemporary truth to what it's representing. And in that sense, I don't know if it's the book glorifies as much as documents what these people do and how they consume. And sometimes I think it's meant to be overkill. I think it's meant to be seen as gross and indulgent and disgusting. And I think that we get a little bit through Rachel's eyes, like, this sense of, you know, like, this is unbelievable. She's having fun, but then she's also grossed out, right?
Yeah.
And kind of thrown.
Well, having a little bit of a stronger sense of what this temptation means to her. Like, she's not exactly Darren from Bewitched saying, you have to give up your, like, indulgences and way of life. She seems to enjoy it a little bit, but be scared of it.
Yeah. She gets dissed for trying on, like, or, like, those outfits on the resort bachelorette weekend. I mean, like, that's painful stuff, right?
But I think there's something really interesting about the overlapping, like, the double consciousness of authority and power that's going on. That being able to trace your family back to an imperial court in 500 AD is important. But also the way that, like, these overseas Chinese are the product of imperialism, of, like, a merchant culture in imperialism, and wealth is a thing that they have to protect themselves. That it really is, you know, sort of these people who have gathered and protected wealth to have stability in a world that was being run from London, now living in a world where they themselves are a little bit more in control and figuring out what that means. And I was really fascinated by those moments when you would just get a glimpse of the Japanese occupation of Singapore and things like that. And you really got a stronger understanding of what it meant to live on an island that had a governor who was born like 5,000 miles away.
You know, it's interesting because I think it's a great question that Lindy posed. Like, mm-hmm. I kept waiting for that to get tripped for me. Like, kept waiting for the real disgust to set in.
Yeah.
Of just like, oh, I can't handle all this capitalist bullshit. And, like, I have to admit, I did start to glaze over all the descriptions and all the label dropping and all that kind of thing. And I think probably, like, midway or two-thirds of the book, I started to, like, skim through it pretty fast.
Where is it just too like, much?
It's too much, in my yeah. opinion. And here's the problem, as just on a pure writer level, is that I don't think his descriptions often are interesting enough.
Yes. Uh-huh.
It's just like the color, the fabric, and the label.
Yeah.
And it's like, you could have so much more fun with that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, like, read Vogue. Like, read somebody who's just over the top in Vogue writing about fashion and do something like that.
Yeah.
And he just didn't do that. And so, when I started China Rich Girlfriend, I was hoping he kind of had upped his game on that level. And to me, it seemed like more of the same.
I think that when you finally get to rich people problems, this is where a lot of these other kind of concerns and issues are addressed. I agree with you that, you know, whenever someone would ask me, oh, is it a good book? I was like, you know, it's frothy.
Yeah.
It's not like eloquent.
No.
You know, and that's kind of missing from it. And but also in terms of like, I don't know, the kind of wealth porn aspect of it. I do think that another like lens through which we view this is from like, all the descriptions of these very rich people who still live in states of various modesty.
Yeah. Right?
In contrast to the newer money that likes to flash everything. Like, so there is the people who display their crazy richness, right? There is a critique of that and of these kind of rampant forms of like, capitalist consumption.
There also isn't.
Is there a critique? Like, or is it
I
just.
I believe there is. Not that, necessarily.
Is
in
the
book.
Critique just the onslaught? Like the fact that we're just getting a huge glut of it and we're supposed to get sick from it.
Well,
it's almost like, okay, cigarettes. Like cigarettes can be okay, a puff or two, a cigarette or two, but if you are forced to smoke 20 at once, you're going to get sick.
Margaret,
right?
Do you want the Surgeon General coming to our podcast?
As the Countess Luann once sang, money don't buy you class.
Yeah.
And I think that that's what this book is negotiating, is really like the difference between class, taste, and taste cultures versus just money, which is crass.
I could have dealt more with like him bringing in more taste culture. I mean, this is a man who went to Parsons.
Yeah.
Like he knows visual culture. Like he knows cool New York shit. Like bring it in more. But can I...
Yeah,
sorry. I just want to tell you guys the two moments that I felt like I got uncomfortable with, like playing about in this capitalist, you know, playing ground. And, you know, it's beyond capitalist, actually. It's like, you know, just straight up imperialism, colonialism, et cetera. One, when you hear about the two Thai ladies in waiting that were bequeathed to Amma, that's uncomfortable. Like, that's on a whole different level.
Yeah.
And then the other moment when, like, one of the maids is like playing Angry Birds and it's like she's a child, you know, like she's a little child on a couch being like, oh, I'm mad at my little game.
Yeah.
Like those are the two moments where I just kind of felt like a little ick factor, where everything else felt like actually in good fun and good spirits.
Mm-hmm. He doesn't step back. Like all of the criticism that goes on is just like, oh, look at Eddie Chang. He's so gross, spending money, trying to be a big deal. And there's never that, like, step back and look at the big picture. And I feel like I would have so loved this book if there had just, out of nowhere, in all of this froth, there had just been a moment where he sort of, like, tried to bring it all together into view. I mean, it's kind of the same as the problem of the description of the dresses. Like, he gives you the facts, but not the synthesis.
I will say that the third novel, Rich People Problems, gives you a lot more history.
Uh-huh.
You get kind of Amma's story.
Yeah.
You get stories about the occupation of Singapore.
Okay.
You learn more about the relationship between the Thai branches of these families and that royal world, but also what, you know, in relationship to the kind of servant class, it's really like you get their stories.
That's great. I'm glad to hear that. You know what that sounds like to me, though? That also sounds like an editor saying this is making a lot of money and I'm going to step in and make this tidy and good in a way that this author, as good as he, I mean, as great as he is and brilliant as he is naturally, like there's still some missing pieces.
Yeah,
and I'm going to come in and smooth it over.
Yeah, I think that, like I said, you know, I wouldn't, again, I wouldn't say that this is sterling prose in any way. And it is almost like reading like kind of extended magazine pieces. He's best actually when he's writing those little excerpts that are pulled from Tattle or whatever.
Yeah.
But that's the thing about rich people problems that really kind of shifts gears for me. Like in the third book, I'm not spoiling anything to say that I think that like a lot of that historical material and, you know, and a lot of the stuff around wealth gets punctured in that book.
Okay, so do you think he does it well?
I'd say that it's done in a pleasing manner. But it's done in a pleasing manner in a way that kind of resolves in a pleasing way, but that obviously like a more serious take on it would have been something worth exploring, but it would have been a radical departure from the rest of the series.
Two minor points. One, I loved that so early on in like the first chapter, he explained to us what a dato was, essentially sort of like a Malay knight. But there was something really nice about sort of saying like, this is going to be a book about the aristocracy, and it is going to have the aristocracy you know and an aristocracy you don't know.
Yeah.
And like that was really nicely done. The other point I will say about names is, you know, I was responsibly trained in a post-colonial literature class to deeply respect the way that the first chapter of Midnight's Children, like, doffs its cap to all of the things that came before it. And that, like, there is a Dr. Aziz because, you know, a passage to India happened and stuff like that. And Kwan attempts, like, the tackiness, like, in the second book, there's a Duchess of Oxbridge, and I wanted to slap him. I was like, you're better than that. You should be able to do better than that. Mm-hmm. And then there is a Countess Finzi Contini. And I was like, if you had, like a reference to in the Garden of the Finzi Continis, and I was like, if you had just been able to do that, like keep that going, it would make me feel like I was in a more glamorous experience. But when you have a fucking Duchess of Oxbridge, I feel insulted.
The breeziness of it.
Yeah.
I will also say, I guess to kind of follow up on the Thai servant comment, like, you know, I'm Filipino. I've lived in Singapore. I've visited Hong Kong. And what the book does depict, I'm not going to say like, well, but it, you know, like what it depicts is like how low Filipinos are on the totem pole in these worlds. And, you know, you get the references to Filipino servants and maids and nannies and caretakers.
And of course, the glorious karaoke reference that is essentially only in the family tree.
Yeah.
Like that one of the kids was so influenced by Filipino nannies.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. The one thing, and I won't, well, whatever. In the third book, they finally do go to the Philippines and it's very different. So I want to just
That's super
that.
Cool. And to me, that actually does a lot of good work.
I don't
work.
Know that it repairs anything.
Oh, okay. Well, I
but,
mean, yeah. it,
but it's
a
just,
gesture
it does
of
it.
Some
it
sort.
What it does is it there is actually in one of the books, I can't remember, like a hierarchical list. Someone is listing the Asian nationalities by order of importance.
Whoa, that is.
And so, like,
so
I think that is
deep.
In the last book. So you do actually get, like, you kind of chip away from, like, that glossy, from the veneer.
And as you read that, did
it.
You feel, like, a resonance with what that list was conveying?
Oh, yeah, I totally felt a resonance with that.
Yeah.
But I also found it striking that the hatred of the Japanese was so strong, given the Japanese occupation of Singapore, that the Japanese, usually on the top of that totem pole to the rest of the world, were listed at the bottom.
Oh, so
anyway,
fascinating.
There you go.
Margaret, can I ask one question of you?
Please do.
I am a bigger fan of Marry, Fuck, Kill Book Club. So can you think of a fourth person to add in for Marry, Fuck, Kill Book Club? book club is person you would want to have in your book club.
Oh.
Yes.
Oh, that's so adorable. Oh. That's such a sweet angle on Fuck, Marry, Kill.
I know. Well, yeah.
Okay. Well, I will answer Fuck, Marry, Kill book club. Fuck Michael. I had the most, like, attraction, raw attraction to Michael. Yeah.
To
the
his fact, cheekbones and Calvin Klein underwear model
at
body.
At first I was kind of like, this guy's a douche. He's just a hot dude, and now he's cheating on her. Fuck him. But then the fact that at the end he comes out that he wasn't cheating on her, he just cannot handle all this wealth.
Yeah.
And beyond can't handle the wealth, can't handle how they treat him. I was like, that's a man who respects himself.
Yeah.
Let me sleep with you.
Yes.
So, yes. And then Mary Astrid, just because I pretty much want to, like, collapse into her soul and body. And yes. I do want her money. Let's just be honest. In a way, I wanted to be Michael.
Yes.
But not leave. Just take her money. Kill Bernard. He's just a little fucker.
Yeah.
And I just don't want to deal with him. So, bye-bye. Also, dogfighting, I hate you. Book club, I think Eleanor.
Oh, wonderful.
Because I feel like she has a lot going on in her mind that I didn't quite... We didn't get access to
also, it. Also, we get as much time with her and her girlfriends as we do with Rachel and Nick. Like, I love her and her girlfriends.
Yeah, I just feel like in a book club, what you do is you drink a lot of wine, like I am right now, and you talk about things that the book touches in you, like traumas, ideas, all kinds of things. And I feel like Eleanor would reveal some stuff in
and
a book
she would
club.
Let you touch her jewelry. Like,
yes.
Those women socially touching jewelry is like a major factor. I love it.
There's a whole thing about people touching jewelry, right? Like, not being allowed to touch. They get frustrated when they're not allowed to touch someone's jewelry.
Oh, really?
Book club. Anyway, whatever. So, my answers. Kitty Pong. Fuck Kitty Pong.
You would fuck Kitty?
Against type. But if it's just a romp, Kitty seems like she'd be a good time.
Yes.
Okay, she does.
You know, Mary Astrid.
Yes.
I think we'd have to compete.
I mean, she was doing some butt play with Bernard.
You know, yeah, there you go. was a kill? Gosh, yeah, probably also Bernard. I mean, there are a lot of people who I feel like I want to kill, but just because, yeah, he's the grossest.
He's the grossest, for sure.
Totally.
I mean, and he's obviously posited as that in the book.
And there are other people I would kill later on in the series. But like in Crazy Rich Asians, the book, I would go with Bernard. And in my book club, I want Amma in my book club because I feel like, depending on the book we were reading, I think that would be a fascinating conversation. And I would have the pineapple tarts.
Good point.
And her cooking all the other stuff.
Wait, did you say who you'd marry?
Astrid.
Oh, okay. Yeah. We'd all marry Astrid.
I would not. I would fuck Colin Koo.
Maybe I should say Araminta might be like actually my fuck. So sorry.
I like that she showed up all androgynous and then turned into a hot model later.
Yes.
Yeah. Like that was a good turn.
Because like Nick's himbo status is just sort of like, no, he can't compete with Colin, especially with his anxiety disorder. I would be there for him.
Yes.
Marry Eleanor. That's a woman who's going to solidify your dynasty.
Oh.
That's a woman who is going to take care of things.
This is your practical side.
Yeah.
Kill, I'm just going to go out on a limb. I mean, Bernard's terrible. Eddie Chang.
Eddie was definitely the second
Eddie's
most
also
terrible.
Second,
yes.
Yeah.
And book club Oliver, of course.
Yeah, of course, Oliver. Yeah.
It's almost a boring choice. All right, you guys, please read Crazy Rich Asians, read the whole collection. We might end up doing more book clubs about the other books just because we're all reading them. So
also,
it's fun.
Go see the film.
Yes.
We didn't talk about it this time because we had to record before the movie was released, and for some reason they had a tight lid on the screeners this time around.
Well, they kept offering us screenings that were exactly during our taping time.
But everyone I know who has seen it said it's really good.
Yeah.
Which... yeah.
And I believe I'm going to be out of town, but you guys will touch upon it next week's show.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So please read the books, get involved, tell us what you thought of them. You're listening to Pop Rocket. We're going to be right back after this with Jamps.
Hey, have you checked out the Max Fun Store recently? We've got a bunch of cool new stuff. For Bubble, we've got a t-shirt, buttons, and more. Reading Glasses fans will love their new library book-inspired shirt. And if you're a fan of beef, check back Friday for the debut of our Beef and Dairy Network merch. We've got all that and more from a ton of Max Fun shows you love. So go check out what we've got and buy yourself something fun at maxfunstore.com.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are
Margaret Wappler
and Karen Tongson.
Every week on Pop Rocket, we ask that age-old question, what's your current jam? Margaret Wappler, what's your current jam?
Well, in the continuing rollout of summer jams, as we're preparing to talk about what is going to be the master jam of the summer, I want to talk about Dua Lipa and Calvin Harris, because this has been my go-to jam. Like, this is Silas and I, every Friday when we're getting tired, it's about 5-6 o'clock, we put on One Kiss, we do some drumming on the chairs, etc. So this is it, One Kiss. One kiss is all it takes, falling in love with me, possibility. Part of the reason I wanted to play this is because I'm about to go to New York City, and this reminds me so much of having like 2 glasses of wine in a New York City bar and then getting out and the night is still steamy and it's the heat is rising off of the pavement. And another thing about Dua Lipa that I think is so adorable is that, you know, her parents are from Albania and her dad is like very passionate about her career and has apparently like put together a music festival in Albania, like that she's going to perform at. And I just think that's so great.
That's wonderful.
I think the song is one of the front runners for Summer Jam.
For sure.
When I listen to it, I feel a pool begin to form around me.
Yeah.
Karen Tongson, you got a jam?
Yes, I do. And I'm going to make this whole night my Crazy Rich Asian night. And my jam is actually from the Cantopop international superstar, Faye Wong, who's name dropped in Crazy Rich Asians, as Oliver describes her to Rachel during Colin and Araminta's wedding. Quote, she's an amazing singer and actress, famously elusive, the Greta Garbo of Hong Kong. Mm. And so Faye Wong is also referred to as Diva, because she is not only a recording artist, but she starred in some Wong Kar-wai films like Chungking Express in 2046. Interestingly, she is one of the biggest Canto pop stars, so Cantonese pop stars, but she's mainland Chinese. She moved there to Hong Kong in 1987. And after about 1997, she switched over to recording songs in Mandarin.
Interesting.
Which is really kind of fascinating. With it. Maybe it coincides with, you know, England relinquishing its ownership of Hong Kong. But in any case, I thought I would play this funny song of hers from 1993, which is a cover of the song Summer of Love, originally recorded by Helen Hoffner. So here is Faye Wong. I mean, one thing that I have to say is that we didn't get to talk about all the different pop star, like pop music star cameos that are in the book and in all of the books. And I mean, it was great to hear or to see Faye Wong being name dropped in the book.
For my jam this week, we got some pretty rough news the day that we were recording. As of our recording, Aretha Franklin is in hospice care. Things don't look great for her. We are, of course, all huge fans. And there was so much that she's made that we could have, like, played. But for me, I love Rocksteady. Yeah. I love Spanish Harlem. Like, there's so much good. But for me, the Aretha I most love is the arrangement of Think from the Blues Brothers, because like everything from the late 60s and 70s, there is like the work and the Aretha sort of like power to it. And this is just a little bit faster, a little bit more self-confident, like not more self-confident, just at ease. Like this is somebody telling her man that he needs to check himself and he already knows that he needs to check himself. Let's listen to it. As a child, when I realized that she was performing that scene in House Shoes, it killed me. It like the backup singers and dancers are her sisters, but like dressed in this beautifully 1980s like black, like we've got jobs, like we're have less systemic sort of like legal discrimination. We're finding a place for ourselves in this country. Magic. Like it is a beautiful. It's also the one moment in that film where like women are getting to talk back to these men who are imagining that their struggles are the only things that matters. It's so good. Also, one other thing. I love in that moment, Aretha, even when she's doing choreography, is just dancing. Like, the fact that she, at all times, whatever she is doing, like, there are ways that, like, Britney Spears, it can look like Semaphore, what she's doing. And when Aretha Franklin is moving, it is because, like, the music is moving her, and it thrills me. And so, Aretha, we send you all of our love. All right, you've been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Guy Brandon, with Margaret Wappler and Karen Thompson. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Azimizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to everybody who gives us 5-star reviews on iTunes. That is so nice and keeps Margaret healthy. This is the second week in a row that we have had only one 5-star review, which may explain Margaret's iron deficiency.
I'm very fatigued.
She's pale. That's why she's going to the Hamptons to recover.
So and to study rich white people.
We need those reviews. Thankfully, What Is Real left a review, so Margaret hasn't fainted yet. What Is Real writes, I've been an occasional listener for a few years and really fell for Pop Rocket this summer while training for my first half marathon. Way to go, What Is Real. The intelligent conversation keeps my mind off the heat and the tedium of running, and it's always motivating to finish a run while the crew share their latest jams. My race is the week of the Summer Jam Special, and I can't wait to have all of those good tunes fueling my run.
This makes me feel like I ran a half marathon, which I really like. More people tell us about how you exercise while listening to us.
Get in touch with us on Twitter, we're at Pop Rocket, or join our Facebook group and get in the discussion. We're a production of MaximumFun.org, and our show is edited by Shayna Deloria, who I still have not met, and our senior producer is Laura Swisher, whom I have met so much.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.